It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport, don't worry. This is the Ticket. We're just kicking it around. Now, two guys who can never go the full 90, Andy Swift and Peter Welpton.
Howdy ho, P1s. Welcome to a World Cup qualifying edition, part two of the Kick Around. Hi, I'm Peter. And joining me today, we got lots of people, but first it is my soccer-talking BFF and rival nemesis Canadian, the great Andy Swift. Hey, buddy.
Hey, good match today.
So should we start the pod by discussing the text exchange at the beginning of the game?
Where you were trying to jinx your team to victory while I was doing the same for mine.
Yeah, why don't you tell everybody what was the text exchange?
I just simply predicted a 2-0 U.S. win.
And right? And then what did I predict?
You predicted a 1-1 tie.
Exactly.
But just for the record, you were predicting a 1-1 tie just to undo my 2-0 prediction for the U.S.
No.
It was all hijinks.
As we talk about this regularly on the show, I don't do sports reverse
sure
Jedi stuff. I am not Bob Sturm. That doesn't work for me. I have no superpowers like that. I predict scores that I honestly think they will be, and I was right yet once again.
You nailed it.
U.S. won, Canada won, and to help us talk about this and break it down, back again, once again, is our good friend, Tyler. Hello, Tyler Kern. How are you today, sir?
I am okay.
Wait, are you drunk? Because you promised that maybe you'd had a few beers in you by the time we did this one. So are you a little tipsy, I hope?
I've had a couple, but not enough.
Yeah?
Not enough. Maybe enough to take the edge off of that that performance, but not enough to really feel the full weight of how I would like to feel at the moment.
So I'm not going to get a drunken rage rant out of you, am I?
No promises, but probably not. Probably not. Yeah.
And just because we love a foursome, our good friend from ThirdDegree.net, everybody's hero, the amazing Buzz Carrick. Come in, Buzz.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for the chance to talk some U.S. soccer with you guys.
Always. We love talking soccer with the good Buzz Carrick. All right. Now, I think the thing that really blew everybody away that started this was the late breaking news that Greg Berhalter's selection and starting 11 was not going to feature Giovanni Reyna, who turned up injured with a hamstring injury and is now not only out tonight, but is going to miss the Honduras game. But the more alarming one, I think, is the fact that Weston McKennie was suspended due to rules violations that we later found out via his Instagram account was a breaking of COVID rules. That's what I'm trying to say. And I'm assuming he's only out this game. Is he now out for the other game too because he's been exposed? I don't know what's going on. Andy, do you know what the COVID protocols are? Are they universal for CONCACAF, or are they different for every nation?
Well, this is a FIFA event, technically. It's not a CONCACAF event, and I haven't worked the qualifier in this octagonal yet, so I'm not sure what the exact protocols are for FIFA. So this could have been a FIFA qualifier protocol, or it could have been very well a U.S. national team protocol.
Tyler or Buzz, have you guys seen anywhere online any kind of specifics? Was he out doing a party again? Was he hanging out with Icelandic supermodels? What? Anybody hear anything?
Go ahead, Tyler.
I haven't seen anything definitive that would say exactly what he did, and I'm going to guess we're probably not going to find out 100% unless Weston tells us, but I could be wrong about that.
You see anything, Buzz?
Only what Weston says is that it was a team COVID protocol. Hmm. He specifically was the language he used.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I would guess is the FIFA probably doesn't have exact protocols in place for the teams to follow. They get tested regularly, either daily or every other day, and then it's up to the teams to keep their players negative, basically. And so, in all likelihood, he broke a team COVID protocol. And that's what led to the suspension, because otherwise FIFA would have issued a statement, not the U.S. national team.
All right. So is there any likelihood that he's also out for the Honduras game on Wednesday?
That's probably up to the team.
Okay. Interesting. The only reason why I bring all this up, and we'll get into the game in a second, was on another podcast, the Guardian Weekly podcast, Barry Glendenning asked Nikki Bandini, who covers Serie A for that podcast, a really unusually pointed and accusatory question about Weston McKennie and really kind of painting him as a troublemaker. And I thought, man, that's really harsh. I mean, I know Weston's had an issue with getting caught having a party once before, but I'm surprised somebody over there thinks him, sees him that way. And Bandini had a really interesting answer that was more about his playing style and what he what she thought about him as a player. But now after this, I don't know if we all need to start rethinking things. Andy?
Tyler,
go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because Juventus has questioned his fitness levels and the effort that he puts into training and that sort of thing. And you almost wonder if it's a perception or reputation type thing with him. But they said that they thought he came in overweight to the regular season.
There
in
Serie A,
yeah, at Juventus and that sort of thing. And so those have been some of the questions that have kind of popped up around around Weston, kind of as a result of maybe some of his behavior. There was also a video. Do you remember? Did you see any of the stuff on Instagram of him just playing pickup out at like Venice Beach?
Yes.
and that sort of thing. You wonder, I mean, I saw it and I was like, hey, that'd be really cool if Weston came to your pickup game. But at the same time, you wonder if, you know, the biggest, most successful team in Italy sees that and says, hey, I wish that our guy that, you know, we just paid $20 million to secure wasn't playing, you know, pickup soccer with a bunch of guys out at, you know,
Venice
out
Beach.
At a beach and that sort of thing. So those are the kinds of questions. And now kind of with another instance here with the U.S., you do kind of take those questions and take those things a little bit more seriously than maybe you did before. Or at least I do, because this is a massive game, right? We were talking about how important this game was, and if there was something that violated team protocol that Berhalter felt was serious enough to keep him out of the team, to me anyways, that's a red flag to me.
Yeah, Buzz, one of the things that I think is just mind-bending, if you just take a second to stop and think about all the games Berhalter has been coached and then take an accounting of the few number of opportunities he's had to play Pulisic, Gio, Tyler Adams, and Weston McKennie at the same time. Has that even happened more than three times in his term as the coach of this team?
Well, I think that's just going to be a product of having your players playing at the highest level. I mean, that kind of availability issues crops up more and more as these guys play these obscene schedules that they play with their club teams, and they're going to be protected and by their club teams and not released all the time. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. It is a problem for Berhalter because the U.S. team is shallow. It drops off fast. He doesn't have the depth that, like, you know, these other countries have where he could just bring in a guy that's almost as good as Pulisic. Like, you take Pulisic out, it's like, who do you get? You go to Roldan? That's a big drop off. So that is a definite problem that Berhalter is going to deal with. Let me tell you, however, that Weston McKennie specifically, I have heard occasionally that his off-field decision-making is not always on point.
Oh, that's not what I wanted to hear, Buzz.
You have to wonder, just not to beat the McKennie horse to death, but you have to wonder why Juventus, after a very solid season that he had, right? I mean, mm-hmm. by all accounts, he was a plus for the team. Suddenly, through the summer and then before the season starts, starts sending out signals that they want to move him. And that kind of came out of nowhere. So yeah. There's got to be another issue that is non-soccer related.
You know, Buzz, you bring up a point about depth and how it drops off. But, you know, when it comes to CONCACAF, does the United States roster drop off that dramatically as compared to anybody other than Mexico? I mean, it certainly is supposed. I think it's better than Canada. I think it's better than El Salvador, isn't it?
I don't know that it's better than Canada anymore. I think it's better than El Salvador. What I mean by drop off is, and this is where coaching really matters, is that this team, this U.S. team, admittedly, there's now what, three or four guys. You got to count Pulisic. You got to count Weston. You got to count Gio Reyna. These, you know, maybe even Tyler Adams. You've got a handful at most of guys that are playing truly elite soccer, and then you have 25 guys that are MLS players or fringe Europe players. You know, your Sargent, who was in D2 and now is going to, you know, Norwich. You know, not Chelsea, not high end. So yes, there's lots of quality throughout the group, but when you take out Weston and Gio, like two of your top three or four in your whole thing, and you're left with Jeff Pulisic, you know, all of a sudden you're just pedestrian. You're just the same as Canada or just the same as El Salvador. And they don't have, well, Canada has a Davies, that's different. So they're kind of have the same ball game where the rest of the team's looking at that star player. The star player is missing. All of a sudden it's like, oh crap, we got to play. And maybe they aren't used to that.
All right. So Tyler, but here's the thing. I'm thinking as we go into this, the concept that Berhalter can put those four guys on the field is like everybody's dream state. And if we're all suddenly now faced with the reality that that may more times than not actually happen, does that change everybody's perspective of how good the U.S. national team really is?
That's a really good question and a hard question to answer because – right, like everyone likes to make the you'll see people on Twitter do this all the time, make the graphic of like a lineup builder of the player's name and then the team that they play for, and they're like, look at all these Champions League guys that we have. And I think that there's okay enough depth, right? Like a Brendan Aaronson plays for a Champions League club, so if he's a backup, like that's not a bad backup to have, and I thought he had a better game tonight. But I do think that it matters, right? There's a reason Gio Reyna starts for Borussia Dortmund, a perennial, you know, top three finisher in the Bundesliga and a Champions League club. And there's a reason why, Weston McKennie is at Juve because he provides value and plays well in those spots. And I do think that they missed a little bit of what Weston brings tonight. And so, I do think that there's a little bit of the perception of the U.S. might not be quite as strong if you're never able to get those four guys on the field at the same time, because look, that's the nucleus of your team. Everyone else, mm-hmm. you can add a John Brooks as an essential part of the team as well, but those are the guys. Those are really the guys that you're looking, you're saying, let's build around these guys. And if you don't consistently have those guys on the field, it makes it hard to say, this is the team we have, this is how we're building forward.
Andy, since you are the resident Canadian fan of this particular episode, I'm gonna ask you, how did you see this game? Are you pleased with the result of the game just from a Canadian standpoint? Do you feel like your team was better than the United States? Were you disappointed not to have won that game?
Disappointed not to have won it because of the opportunities they had to score that second goal at the end, but not disappointed in the result. Clearly, you come in on the road, as we talked about in CONCACAF, if you get a point on the road, you have to be happy, especially if it's one of the top two teams in the region, U.S. being one of those two top teams. So, you know, ultimately, I think that the point, I was happy to get the point. I was happy that, that Canada showed well. But I kind of disagree about the depth issue with the U.S. I still think when those four guys aren't on the field at the same time, obviously the U.S. is not as good as they would be if they were all four on the field at the same time. But let's set Mexico aside. What other national team in this region wouldn't say the same about their top four guys? If their top four guys aren't on the field at the same time, they're not going to be as good. The U.S. mm-hmm. is no different. So then remove those four guys and look at everybody else you have on your roster, 1 through 25 or 5 through 25, and you can't say Canada or El Salvador or Honduras or Costa Rica at this moment are any better than the U.S. I think the U.S. is still clearly the team with the most depth. The one issue they have, in my eyes, is they still haven't solved the striker issue. And that, to me, should be the most worrying factor of this octagonal schedule, right? I mean, of this qualifying series now that we're going to play over the next several months. They have to solve the issue at striker, I think. And if they don't do that, then they have some issues.
All right. Buzz, let's move into Berhalter's starting 11. And based on what we know in terms of, suspensions and injuries and et cetera, and trying to give guys some rest, what did you think when you saw the starting 11?
Well, I think it looked just like the team and the concept and the style and the method that Berhalter's played pretty consistently throughout this last year. I mean, the tactics were set up the same. It's a single pivot, Adams with the two double eight look in front of him. Because of the missing personnel, maybe it's a little more workmanlike midfield when you have the Adams Acosta, you know, combo with I'm brain farting who the third player was in there. Leggett. Yes. Mm-hmm. Some quality guys, but workmanlike quality guys, right? There's a little bit of, and this was one of my overall takeaways watching the game play as it played out. And I thought it was fairly obvious that this was going to be the case when you saw the lineup, is that for the most part, most of the game was 10 dudes watching Pulisic try and progress the ball. Because you look at those three guys, Acosta, Leggett, and Adams, none of those three guys will pass forward, but they won't turn and go. They won't dribble progress, and they won't dribble try and beat a guy to make a blind break and to get into the next gap. So the whole game was Pulisic receiving the ball at midfield, trying to turn and getting fouled. And everyone else is just sort of standing him do that, watching him do that. So it's...
That's where I think this team really missed Weston McKennie, yeah. Is he will make those sorts of runs. And it's a reason why I think a lot of U.S. fans, especially FC Dallas U.S. fans, would really love it if Paxton Pomykal can stay healthy for an extended period of time and actually get a run in this team at some point. I think now that qualifying is underway, the kind of experimental phase is largely over. But that's something that you're right, Buzz, that this team lacks from the midfield if Weston's not in there, and that a guy like Paxton would provide. Yes,
yeah, Gio not in there too. Made it even worse. And as much as I thought Aaronson covers a lot of ground and does a ton of movement that Prefolk wasn't doing and was trying to contribute offensively, he too is not a guy that checks back, receives, turns, and progresses. Only Pulisic of the team tonight does that, and that left you flat. And the other component with that lineup was because the United States under Berhalter mostly uses false wings, right? They don't weigh us out. He's hurt, right? So it's Pulisic, it's Gio, it's Aaronson, it's guys that are playing narrow, guys that are coming underneath, guys that are hunting for the ball. So they're left with these being forced to use outside backs that are these really offensive, heavily overloaded, getting forward outside backs, Yedlin, Dest, Robinson on the other side, you know, guys that are not particularly good defenders. And so you're going into a game against Davies, who is a pure wide guy, as dominant as he is. He's a wide back or midfielder, and he spent the whole game on that line destroying the right backs, who none of whom can play any defense at all. So you had to watch most of the game, Acosta running over there, Adams running over there, trying to help out. All that you could see when the lineup came out. You know, if you know how those guys play, you knew what was coming. You know that Dest hasn't played any defense since he was 15. So it was going to be, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, when you have to go up against Alphonso Davies, that's going to be a rough day for you, even if you're a good defender. And he is not a good defender. And he did not have a good first half. Other than like one or two little things he did going forward, he was a mess most of it.
I have a question about Dest for the group. Because, you know, we spoke about this after the last game. He didn't have a good game. I think, Tyler, you had some really good points to make about Dest. And then I think you can go back to the Gold Cup, right, where he had some issues in the Gold Cup. So, you know, do you start to question now Berhalter starting him this game and not just starting Yedlin right away, which, you know, maybe... the drop off to Yedlin, and Yedlin has his own issues, and that's why you didn't do that. But with the Davis's speed and Dest's inability to defend, was that the right call?
Well, let me just throw out there. I seem to recall that the last time these two teams faced, Dest went up against Davies and had a really good game against him. Am I remember that incorrectly?
Yeah, maybe that's right. But remember, I think Dest didn't have an overall good tournament and had issues the last game they played, perhaps. I just remember not having a great feeling about Dest after Gold Cup, in particular. Dest.
Well, I don't think anybody had a good feeling about him. Definitely after the El Salvador game, I just mm-hmm. when everybody started wondering who was going to play Alphonso Davies, it was brought up in a lot of places that, well, hey, the last time this happened, he was facing Davies and he actually played really well and kind of kept him quiet. Now, I don't remember that off the top of my head, but again, Dest is certainly the ultimate double-edged sword, or at least but he's not even going forward. He's not even attacking very well.
Davis didn't play in the Gold Cup.
Well, then there was a game somewhere where they played against each other.
They played twice in Nations League, right? And they lost the first one to Canada, and everyone kind of had a panic moment where they lost that game. And then the next time they played, the U.S. played much better and won that game.
But didn't have Davies in it.
Yeah, but Davies didn't play, right, Peter? Yep, correct. Yep. So yep. I don't know if we have much to go by then.
Well, I think it's the 2019 game, because I know for a fact at one point they did play against each other, and everybody thought Dest took it personally as a personal challenge because Afonso's was like the star of CONCACAF playing for Bayern Munich, and he had just started his stint at Barcelona, or at least playing for them. Again, I'm sure some other podcast or somebody's article will flesh this out, but my point being in all of this is that if there's going to be an ongoing story about these first two games, I think in many ways at least 1B to 1A is going to be what in the hell is going on with Sergiño Dest, our guy that plays at Barcelona.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think Dest represents kind of the conundrum of the modern fullback, right, where they become so integral in the attacking sense that the defense is a secondary consideration, and especially with the way that Berhalter wants to play and the way that you see a lot of like these modern club managers playing, is that the fullback is intended to be so attacking that it's I think the idea is you pin Davies back as much as possible and ask him to defend more often than attack, using a guy like Sergiño Dest pushing forward. And look, I mean, that's the concept, right? Whether or not that works in practice is a whole nother story, but you look around, you know, the world at the best fullbacks in the world, at a Trent Alexander-Arnold, you think of him so much more in terms of what he provides in the attack than what he does defensively. And Andy can correct me if I'm wrong, being the resident Liverpool expert, but that's at least my perception of some of these guys that kind of started changing, you know, with Marcelo and Dani Alves and those types of guys.
Yeah,
but if you're talking about Liverpool specific, their fullback play, I mean, those guys defend first, and they just happen to be good defenders. They happen to be defenders that do well on offense, I think. I mean, that's my perception. I mean, Robertson is, like, he's a defender first. He's a good defender.
That's a different conversation. I think Trent is more attacking first, defense second. Robertson, defense first, attacking second. But it's a quibble thing. I want to point out to everybody that America's best chance was essentially created and started by Dest, and Canada's best chance of the first half was essentially Dest getting caught out of position on Davies. So he's tied to both ends of it, and that's why he's so critical to this whole thing, which I find interesting. Another really interesting and I think entertaining performance from Mr. Tyler Adams. I said this the last podcast, and I'm gonna reiterate it here. I still think he stamps himself as the most important player on Berhalter's system, because I think he almost single-handedly kept Canada from winning this game in by destroying things earlier in the process.
I thought he actually got lucky to have not gotten sent off.
I would agree with you too. Yeah,
and then he got lucky
on that foul when the team was attacking, when the U.S. was attacking.
Yeah, because I watched him off ball. I watched him, and he turned and lit that guy up. That was not I just ran into him. Oh no, he turned and lit him up. Now he made it look good, but it was off the ball, way behind the play. And he did it on purpose, and you're lucky because that's the whole argument of intentional, right?
It was shoulder to shoulder, so I think it's a yellow card. I don't think it was a red card.
I'm not talking about the PK.
I know what you're talking about. You're talking about where he mowed over Antonio Kay.
Yeah, and I know.
And that was shoulder to shoulder, but it was a yellow card. I agree. I don't think it was an objectionable.
I'm just saying that, like, this referee was a let-him-play referee.
Yeah.
And I can see a referee saying that's the difference between deliberate and intentional. And you lined that guy up and was nowhere near the ball. That was 100% intent to foul, that knocked that guy over. It wasn't part of the play. It was way behind the play, way after it. So it's, for me, that's a moment where a different ref, he could be gone. And then I also think he got lucky that it wasn't a PK at the end of the game when he came in from behind on it. Was it Bachman? Buchanan, sorry, over on the right, the Revolution guy, who looks really good too, by the way. So, and I also think that I can remember back to the Gold Cup when Kellen Acosta played as a six and was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that Adams is one of the most important players in Berhalter's system. I don't think it's as big a gap as it was once we saw Acosta could do almost the same thing. You know, but I didn't think Adams had a particularly great game. There was, for me, I watched a lot of possession.
Because I kind of agree with Peter. Yeah, I agree with Peter, though. I think you're spot on about that foul. But my notes was like, yeah, Adams was so valuable in the first half particularly.
Here's why I'm saying that I didn't think he had a particularly good game was because I watched a whole lot of United States possession, a lot of it happening in the midfield, and very little penetration into the offensive end. And Adams is one of your guys in the midfield who can pass pretty well. And it also falls on Costa and legit. I can't. Wow, it's a brand for him tonight. None of those guys were making those in-road passes into the box and finding people, right? So to me, that's like the thing that was missing from this game was the ability for anyone in the midfield to get the ball to the feet of a guy in a dangerous position. When the U.S. finally scored, it's because they finally had a nice team concept play through the middle, get wide, and get back across to where Aaronson made the back post run. So that was, for me, the difference in the game and why the U.S. didn't get it done is because none of the three guys in the midfield, and I include Tyler Adams in that, found offensive players with the ball to their feet in dangerous positions.
Tyler, if you were to make a comparison of tonight's game and the game in San Salvador, did the U.S. play better, worse, or about the same?
I think they played. I think they played better in that they created more chances tonight through the run of play. Not enough, obviously, but I think that they played better in that sense. I think what they came up against, and I'm curious to get y'all's thoughts on this, is it almost feels like Canada pulled a USA circa Bob Bradley on the US. Does that make sense? Right? Like 22% possession, whatever, and didn't really care if they had the ball or not. They knew when they got it they could be dangerous enough, and their talented attacking players made a play when it mattered and they got a result. And it kind of reminded me of that kind of style of play. I thought the US played better tonight, but just not good enough. And I do think that the midfield struggled to progress the ball into dangerous attacking areas. I don't think PFOC gave them enough option to play it forward too often. And the striker thing to me is a big problem for this team as they move forward into qualifying.
Buzz, I know some people are listening to this and upset that Ricardo Pepi didn't get time in this game. And I think Stuart Holden was like, oh, yeah, Pepi time. And there's a part of me that thinks, no, I don't think it's the right time for the kid at this point. I don't want this funk on him this early in his national team career. And I also wonder, you know, is he ready for this? And Buzz, you know him better than anybody else on this pod. Do you think Pepi should be playing yet?
I don't think I would start him, but I actually think it's important that you get him into at least, it's got to be the third one, you get him into a game during this camp. Now, generally speaking, when you bring in a young guy to his first camp, I am usually okay with the idea that you're just in mainly for the camp. You're in to get the vibe, you're in to get to sit on the bench on some of these road games. But in Pepe's particular case, he's a kid that is ready mentally for everything that's coming at him right now. He's more mature in terms of game terms. I'm not talking about his real life. I don't know that. But in terms of game terms, he's mature mentally. So he is more than capable of coming off the bench in any one of these games and being 100% ready and 100% a legit contender. Now, I know why Berhalter to this point hasn't used him, because he doesn't really know him yet. He hasn't really trusted him. I try to tell people all the time that, like, the way national team coaches think, they have a team, you know, and they look to rotate guys in on the bottom a little bit, but they have a group in their head, right? They have a 20 or a 25. And in order for you to get up into those rotations, you got to come into a camp. You got to do well in the training enough for them to then put you into a game. And then you got to do something in the game. But in his case, with all this back and forth with Mexico, all this stuff talk about, oh, we love Pepe, he's been part of the conversation, I think it's really important you get him into a game in these three games. And I thought for sure tonight was a night. I agree with Dax McCarty at halftime that this would have been a good occasion to bring him in the second half. Maybe go with the two-striker system or not. Dax talks a lot about, and I agree with him on this too, they needed to go wide and try and get the ball in. That's how they scored. They needed to do more of that because the inside passing and the Pulisic dribbling wasn't working. They needed to change the way they were doing it, and they never did. They didn't get any wide play from their outside backs, and both wings were false wings, so they didn't get any wide play from the wings. And I think that cost them.
I would add to what Buzz says, Peter, that with the rotation, the necessary rotation and the roster rotation that you need with three games in 7 days, you can't have anybody on the roster you're not willing to show some minutes. And so the fact that he's on this roster for these three games, I think they're prepared to play him. And I think, you know, do you want to play him today and give him minutes today, or do you want to do it in Honduras and Tegucigalpa? You know, today I think would have been a better situation for him.
You sit still, Andy, because we're gonna ask you to tell everybody about that joint here before we end this particular episode. Tyler, where are you on? If I'm gonna ask you, so where, if you were gonna give Berhalter a grade, what grade would you give him so far through these first two games?
Ooh, that's, man, you're coming with the hard hitters tonight, Peter. I'm gonna give him a C. Because it's not a sky is falling scenario yet. I thought, man, the subs took way too long in the second half tonight, and I really think that's on Berhalter. The game needed to change in some way, and I thought the U.S. was way too slow to react. Canada undercut them basically by making the attacking substitutions first and kind of putting the U.S. on the back foot at a time when the USA really should have been pinning Canada back and pushing for the go-ahead goal. Bringing on Tejan Buchanan, I thought, really livened things up for Canada at a time when you would have thought that the U.S. would have been pushing forward a little bit more. So I'm concerned about that, and I'm concerned about how he's deploying some of these players and what changes he's going to make moving forward. So yeah, I'm giving him a C, leaning towards a C minus.
Okay, hold on. There's two very different parts to your answer I want to break down a little bit. The first part is the question about substitutions and how late he went with it. Considering who he had to put on and who he was taking off, I'm going to ask you, are you really, think about that for a second. If he had put on those three guys 5-10 minutes earlier, do you really think that would have been better? Because I think there's a significant drop-off in the quality of the players between Aronson, Prefock, and who was the third guy he took off? Legette? Was it Legette? And then putting on Roldan, Sargent, and whoever the other person was that he put on. Who was the third? I forget now.
Conrad.
Conrad. You see where I'm going with this? Like,
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
That's his thinking. Is it's not like I'm making an even Steven swap. So that's the first part. And now I've totally brain farted on what my second. What was the other point you made? Your answer had two parts to it. It was the quality of the people, and what was the other part? Tyler, help me out here.
And maybe how they're being deployed, utilized, things like that.
Yes. Okay. That's kind of my larger question. Is what, you know, if somebody else is manager of this team. If pick whoever you want it, if it's Pep Guardiola, right? What is that coach doing differently tactically with this same group of players that Berhalter is not getting right? And so we can break. Somebody can answer part one and part two. I don't care. I think those are two really interesting things to talk about.
Sure, I agree with Tyler that the subs are way too late. You know, I Peter, I know what you're saying about the quality of the people you're bringing on, but 8 minutes is not enough to do anything. In 8 minutes, you're barely getting into the game, you know, because it takes 3 or 4 or 5 minutes to get into the game. So you're going to spend half the time just sort of finding the ball, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't do those subs at like, you know, 70 minutes and give those guys 25 minutes-ish or more, then there's no chance for them to make any impact on the game. It's just not going to happen. So those subs are way too. It doesn't matter who it is, whatever you're, you know.
So
unless
you're
just.
So why do you think Berhalter waits so long?
Honestly, I don't know. Okay. I don't have an answer to that question because I was baffled. I was sitting there at home, scratching my head, wondering what is he waiting for? You know, it's not like there was a sign in the game at that point. Because Canada had gotten on the front foot and they had scored and they had tied the game. And it's that point that I thought, you need to get some momentum back here. You need to bring in somebody offensive. You need to make some changes. You need to give some guys an opportunity. My only thing I think of is that the people that he started, he has so much confidence in them that he wanted to give them as much time as possible. But he waited so long that his solutions that he was bringing on had no time to have any impact. So therefore, my only assumption is that he really didn't believe in those solutions very much. He only went to them because it was like, well, I'm out of time. I got to try something. But it's too late.
I'm almost wondering, too, if he had tactical changes in mind for a 1-0 game and he was confident that he wasn't going to lose that 1-0 lead. And then once Canada tied it, it kind of changed everything and they had to kind of rethink what they were going to do. And that just took some minutes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just wonder, I think that's a part of it. And I also wonder his confidence level in giving up the overall, even all the points with his substitute. If he put those guys out there too early, would the team become too loose in Canada somehow end up winning the game overall? So, Tyler, let's go back to part two of your answer, which is, all right, somebody else, the world's best coach, is coaching this team. What is he doing different tactically? And I'm going to let Buzz also answer this, but I'm going to go to you first, Tyler.
It's tough. Again, it's tough to say, right? But I do think that there is an element to coaching a national team that is different than coaching a club team because you do have limited time with these specific players, right? And I think that Berhalter has really approached the U.S. men's national team as though it's a club team, which is why I think he's stuck so closely to the same group. It's kind of like what Buzz was mentioning earlier just in the Ricardo Pepi conversation, that you have to have time to bring in a guy, see how he fits into your system, see how he fits into everything that you do and your overall concepts and that sort of thing. And I think what Berhalter has tried to institute is kind of that pseudo Man City-esque approach where you overload certain sides. You look to create triangles kind of in and around the corners of the box and that sort of thing. And that be what the U.S. tries to do. And I think a different manager would come in and maybe simplify just a little bit and look at what the U.S. has at their disposal and maybe not be so. It's a similar thing to how I feel about Lucci. Quite often is sometimes you just in these sorts of situations need to be more pragmatic more than idealistic when it comes to how you'd like to play and all of the philosophy of we want to play with the ball and we want to disorganize with the ball and that sort of thing. Sometimes you just have Christian Pulisic and you need to get him isolated one-on-one against an outside back, right? And it we don't need to overcomplicate things sometimes. And too often I feel like he wants to play Pep Guardiola ball. And in the end, it's 11v11, and you're not always going to be able to institute those sorts of things at the international level, is my primary thought.
We don't need Pep. We don't need Bora at the other end of the spectrum, right? Bora ball.
Yes, I think that's well put.
That's really old school. Buzz, you're the kind of the tactician of the group here. Are you unhappy, pleased, mediocre, milquetoast on Berhalter's tactical execution so far in these two games?
Well, other than the late subs, I don't mind his tactics. I actually like the way he wants to play. I have no issues with that. I do, however, have issues with roster construction. And I think tonight you saw that. And I already talked about a couple of them. There's no true wingers. Everyone's a false wing, right? There's nobody that can run. I'm talking about not outside backs. I'm talking about high wingers. There's no Michael Barrios. I mean, that's a bad example because he's not American, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. You mean Weah's like an Alfonso hurt. Davies?
Like a Davies. Weah's hurt, right? That's what his guy probably, you know, he made some choice. De La Fuente's hardly played it for anybody ever. So, like, that's a bad, we're bringing him on. He doesn't even play for his club team. All right, number two was all the outside backs, as a consequence, are attacking outside backs. There's no defensive outside back on this roster. Now, you can say, oh, we got Kellen Acosta we can put out there. If an emergency, I can put Tyler Adams out there if I have to. Particularly on the right side, both Yedlin and Dest are attacking outside backs, are terrible defenders. There's no, I don't know, just to be biased completely, there's no Reggie Cannon who can defend as well as attack on this roster. Now, maybe you come in a everything's a rosy situation and you don't need a guy. But in CONCACAF, how often is everything rosy? And let's carry it even further, right? We've talked about the striker issues, and you brought in Sargent, who's as yet unproven. You got Jordan Pickford, who up there, who is as yet unproven and really static. And you've got Pepe, who is yet unproven and really static. You didn't give yourself any options of a veteran kind of crap, it's late in the game, I'm going to bring in Taylor Twellman, or I'm going to bring in, you know, Wando. I'm going to bring in Wando, you know,
Alan, it's CONCACAF.
Yeah, it's CONCACAF qualifying. It's right. The roster was made for everything rosy. There's no, and then the last one is, how many center backs are on this team? I mean, Brooks looks like he just got off a plane, which he did. Walker Zimmerman's probably not going to play. Sands is not going to play, right? Robinson looks good. We like him, of course.
But he looks fantastic.
Yeah, so Weston McKinney, not Weston McKinney, I'm sorry. Who's the other? There's another center back. Oh, Mark McKenzie, right?
Yeah.
Why are all these center backs on the roster? Are we going 3-5-2? Is that why? Because then that covers up for Dest, maybe, if you're going that. But then he didn't do that. So why are there so many center backs when you could have had some other options? So to me, that's the big problem for me in this three game stretch. The roster to me looks like a everything is going great roster, not a this is CONCACAF, and I might have to do, can I cuss, some weird ass shit because it's CONCACAF. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They weren't ready. So, there's some problems here for this.
I think that's a great point, Buzz.
Follow-up question.
Yeah.
Follow-up question that I would love to get anybody's answers on this. In his post-game press conference just now, Greg Berhalter said that he is open and they are exploring options to replace Giorena for the next game and possibly McKennie and Dest. So with that being the case...
Holy crap.
Who would you bring in that you think could make a difference in this roster that's not already here?
Well, you know, look, if you lose Dest, bring in a fullback that brings a different component than Yedlin. You know what you have in Yedlin.
I agree.
Give yourself flexibility in that position. That's not going to be a game changer, but you cover your bets, right? I mean, I don't know what I'm going to need 3 days from now, even if I'm ready to go with Yedlin as a starter, what might I need off the bench? Do I need a defender off the bench? Do I need an attacker off the bench? Give yourself some flexibility. If you're looking at bringing in Gio, right, you've already got Aronson, who's playing basically like Gio plays, and Pulisic plays like Gio plays. So if you're going to bring in a body as a winger, go get a real winger, like a wide guy that can at least alter the way you play some. Right, so that would be my suggestion. If you're going to bring in some bodies, is try and give yourself some options and some flexibility and an ability to change the game. This is what we talk about Lucci all the time, right? He brings in the same sub that he just took out, right? It's the exact same player. You're hoping that the guy's fresher because he hadn't been playing for 60 minutes, but you didn't change anything. You didn't change the shape. You didn't change the tactic. You didn't change the idea. Give yourself some options.
Yeah. Wow. Tyler, do you have, because I'm sitting here racking my brain for three players to bring in, and I would say Reggie Cannon would be an option, but Reggie hasn't played in forever, and he's been bouncing around trying to get a deal at a different club. And I mean, I don't know. What that situation be an option for McKennie would be some other midfield player, and I'm sure there's a whole litany of guys that we could talk about, but none of which even begin to approach the Weston level of play. And then somebody for Gio, I get Buzz's point about it, somebody that will play wide, but again, who is that in the pool at this point that is of quality that you think can actually start or succeed in the CONCACAF qualifier?
Hoppy.
Jesus Ferreira.
Well, if you want somebody to play underneath Jesus, you can get Matt Hoppy, whatever his damn name is, as a legit winger. He can play wing, even though he's mostly a nine.
Okay, that's a good shout.
And if you want to get crazy at right back, bring in Brian Reynolds. Not Cannon.
Yeah.
Brian is an X factor with his. I'm not saying like he's not Mr. Reliability. He's not going to give you like, oh, I'm a lockdown defender like Reggie could do. But if you want a guy that might get crazy on the outside and give you something totally different going forward, that dude can cross and whip and drive past players at the dribble like nobody on this current team can do. So that would be my guys, those two to bring in. In the midfield, I don't know who. I mean, I don't know who you bring in for
me. Tyler, you got any genius ideas? We're screwed!
No, I actually do think Jesus Ferreira isn't the worst option right now.
Dallas
honestly,
homers.
It's true, but also
think,
in terms of
that kid's on
I think
fire.
It's legit.
Yeah,
I think in it's terms a of legit shout out.
In terms of guys who've been aggressive dribbling through midfield, I mean, you just have to watch the goal against Real Salt Lake.
Sure.
Where he dribbles past everyone, schools Justin Glad, a guy that's been with the U.S. men's national team and has been around the program, like puts him on his butt and then roofs it Landon Donovan v. Slovenia 2010 style. And then goes
horns down on UT.
that's a penalty in the Big 12 this year, just making sure everybody knows that. Anybody that you bring in is probably not going to start. They're going to be there for cover and to be there as maybe a bench option late on in a game. But I wouldn't, especially since Jesus Ferreira's been a guy that's been around the program and had a nice camp earlier on this year. I think that he could potentially be an option, especially, I mean, he's got 5 goals and 5 assists in, you know, playing in the midfield this year. And if you're looking for someone who is a little bit more aggressive going forward, I think we've seen that from Jesus this year. So I wouldn't mind seeing him get called up. He can provide you cover in a couple of different spots. So, that's my best shout as far as center mid goes. On the right, honestly, the best right back option for me anyways, especially if you're looking for someone who's more of just a stay-at-home defender, is a guy who's caught between two federations, and it's Julian Araujo, who plays for the LA Galaxy, but he hasn't committed to the U.S., so that's a tough one.
All right.
I actually think if you're going to bring in Jesus, you bring him in to start at 9, because if you're unsatisfied with your two guys that have started at 9 so far, and you think, there's no way I can start 18-year-old Pepe on the road at Honduras, Jesus is a dude that actually has produced for your national team and has actually played in some tougher places than we just saw against Canada. So, like, if you're desperate for a 9, I think that's not a horrible shout as a 9,
sure,
more than a midfielder.
And he's played exclusively as a 9 under Berhalter with the U.S., and so it's not the most outlandish thing that you could see happen. I'm not opposed to it. He's played more as a false 9 who kind of drops into midfield, but he gives you that option of someone who keeps possession, and tonight that just didn't happen enough. The U.S. just kind of would get swallowed up every time they tried to go through the middle. So,
all right, I'm going to ask Tyler and Buzz to sit for a second and cogitate on who they think will end up or who they would like to see starting against Honduras, at least based on the roster as we know it now, while I go to Andy, who is our CONCACAF expert and has probably been to this stadium multiple times in his CONCACAF professional career as a match commissioner. Andy, tell us all about this lovely vacation spot in Honduras.
Yeah, so I said that they were going to play in Tegucigalpa, and I was wrong. They're actually going to play in San Pedro Sula, which is the
That's
de
worse,
facto...
Right?
Pardon me?
That's worse, right?
It's worse, actually, yeah. And it's not in the capital, and the fact that they play the most of their national team games there speaks to the conditions that visiting teams encounter when they go there. Tegucigalpa, that stadium is intimidating, but the Estadio Olimpico in San Pedro Sula, where they're going to play, is not as intimidating in terms of how the stadium is built and the sound and how the crowd can be very imposing. What is intimidating at San Pedro Sula is actually the weather. It's hot and it's muggy. I think it'll be like in the mid-90s with the humidity in the 80% range when the U.S. plays there on Wednesday. It's going to be really sticky. And it's far from ideal when you're playing your third game in 7 days. So I think that's something Berhalter is going to have to think about when he draws up the lineup for this match. And, you know, Honduras, they will have played 2 road games, so they are going to be playing their first home match of this qualifier round. So they are going to have a certain kind of motivation as well of playing in front of their home fans for the first time in a while. So
right,
that's what the U.S. is facing.
Is Honduras as nasty, better, about the same as trying to play in front of the El Salvadorians? And does it have a fight cage around the field too there?
I'm sure it has the fencing around the stadium. From what I remember, it does. The stadium in Tegucigalpa is a little bit more intimidating from that perspective. I would say the stadium in El Salvador is probably the most, out of all the ones in Central America, the most intimidating. The fans are a little bit farther away from the action in this stadium. It's an Estadio Olimpico. They call it the Estadio Olimpico because they run track and field, so it's got that shape. And as you know, those stadiums that have the track, the fans aren't as close. So that takes away a little bit from the intimidation factor. Again, they play the games there, especially against teams like the U.S. that don't do well in that weather. Because I've done games in Tegucigalpa, the other stadium in the capital, when they play teams like Jamaica. I've done a qualifier, Honduras, Jamaica, and they moved that game to the other stadium where their fans are really intimidating because Jamaica wasn't going to be affected as much by the weather. But against the U.S., against Canada, they'll take into San Pedro.
And it is a grass field. It's not the turf field in Central America.
Correct.
That
it's
I keep thinking.
Grass.
Which one is the one that used to be artificial turf?
Costa Rica. That's the one in Costa Rica.
Is it still there? Is it still turf?
I think the Olympic Stadium in Costa Rica is grass, but the club team stadiums are turf.
Okay.
They have a lot of turf fields in Costa Rica.
All right, Buzz or Tyler, who wants to go first in terms of talking about who they'd like to see starting on Wednesday night? I'm not going to
go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, okay, Tyler, you go first.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Oh, geez. That's very Canadian of you.
Oh, geez, guys. Oh, geez. I think Berhalter brought so many center backs because he planned at some point to go three in the back. And so I'm going to say that he rolls out and goes three in the back and puts Sands in the middle of the back line, which is a far shout. I'm going out on a limb here, and I say that he puts Sands in the middle of Brooks and Robinson. But what I think that might change and do a little bit is we saw so many times Tyler Adams dropping between the two center backs, right? And that takes a midfielder out of your buildup. And so if you go three in the back, you can actually be a little bit more attacking by leaving your midfielders a little bit further up the field and kind of pressing and pushing those guys up a little bit, knowing you have some defensive cover. I think we see George Bello at left back at some point, or at left wing back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go with that. Yedlin at right wing back if Dest isn't healthy. If Dest is healthy, then he definitely goes at right wing back against Honduras, I think, with Pulisic, Sargent, and Aronson up top. With Acosta and Adams, I think, would be the double pivot if McKennie's not back. If McKennie's back, then I go Adams, McKennie in the midfield.
The other thing that I'm interested in that lineup is that Sands actually can play some midfield, and if he is playing mm-hmm. in kind of that position, he can carry the ball forward, and that does present some opportunity there, I think. Although he's so young and green, man, getting your first start in Honduras is trial by fire for certain.
It's wild, and I'm sure I'm going to be wrong, and I'm sure it's going to be like Tim Ream back there somewhere or something that. But
not Tim Ream.
I know, but like this is half what I would like to see, half what I think Berhalter might do.
So, all right, Buzz, let's hear your 11.
Well, I'm now mad because I thought I had this great plan that I was going to let Tyler do his thing, and then I was going to be, ha-ha, three at the back, and be like, look at me. And instead, Tyler did three at the back and wrecked it. I got Mark McKenzie coming in as the third center back in my head. I agree about Yedlin on the right. I have Kellen Acosta left wing back because my entire reason to go three at the back is to overload the midfield and try and control the game that way down there.
What about Anthony Robinson, who I think plays that role? He can play that role well, can't he?
He can probably. He hasn't stood out for me. And I think Kellen's shown over the last 2 months that he has a little moxie, and having him on the field and a little gamesmanship, I think that's, I want to keep him on the field. And so I think I put him out wide, and that leaves me like a legit Adams combo in the middle. With Pulisic in front of him as the playmaker. And then here's my other change. I go back to Sargent, but I go ahead and start Pepe on the
really?
Road in Honduras. Yeah, because I think you need to play him, and I think you need to roll the dice. Because let's say it goes bad. You've got five subs, right? So you can just take him off at halftime or whatever. It's not going to – he's a forward. It's not going to kill you.
Are you trying to sell T-shirts, Buzz?
I am trying to sell T-shirts. I want to – because I want them to say that El Tren is starting and I can – and sit in my little puddle of joy. And no, I legitimately think that – look, the tonight Pickford was static. He just stood in the center channel
Prefock.
A lot. Prefock. I'm sorry. I called him Pickford. Because I'm looking at the roster and it says Jordan – man, I can't even on his last name. I thought he was too static. And I thought that was true of Sargent for the most part, too. And we know how active Pepe is. Pepe loves to move. He loves to pull defenses apart. I think, like, going to a Latino country is not going to intimidate Ricardo Pepi. He's from El Paso. It's not the same, I know, but he's a guy who's been across that border a million times. He's got tons of family in Mexico. I don't think he's going to be intimidated by a road trip to Central Northern America. I just don't. So for me, like getting him on, like two legit strikers getting him on because Pepi can go a little bit wide and he can move and he can put defenses under stress. I think it creates room for whoever the other striker is, which is Sargent in this scenario I'm promoting, and it creates room for Pulisic underneath.
There's almost that element sometimes where with young players where it's almost like they're so young and inexperienced and green that they don't realize that there should be pressure on them.
You mean they're too dumb to know the better?
Have you guys met, I don't know how much you've talked to Pepi. I compare him, and I don't mean this as a negative. I talked about him several times lately where I've said he's like Nukalush and Bull Durham. And I don't mean that he's dumb, because he's not. I mean that he is blessed with a lack of self-doubt. That kid has absolute self-belief that he can produce. He will not be a guy that you're going to put in there that's going to panic. He's going to be a guy that's going to put in there, he's going to be like, I'm going to bring it today, and he'll go after it. That's just, you've seen every time that Dallas has ever put anything in front of him difficult, he's risen to the occasion. Hat trick in his first ever pro game, right?
Yeah,
he went up against Frank O'Hara, who's a $3 million player for competing for a roster spot, and he was so confident that he predicted he would score 25 goals this year. Right?
Yeah.
That's the kind of guy we're talking about.
And buries the penalty against the Liga MX All-Stars in the All-Star game. And I've always kind of thought of him as a low heart rate guy, right? Where it never looks like he is super stressed out about things, right? You have guys that are all energy active. Like Brendan Aaronson, I think is like a high activity, hyperactive guy. Whereas Pepi, Paxton, he's always moving. And yeah, Paxton, definitely. But then you look at Ricardo Pepi, it's not that he's not moving, it's not that he's not playing hard, but it just always looks like he's kind of just like a shark, just kind of looking for his spots and that sort of thing. And I could see that working. I really could.
Yep, that's food for thought. But now that you guys have mentioned it, in my tiny little head, I'm working up a scenario where they do call up Jesus Ferreira and he hooks up with Ricardo Pepi and the Huntsmen save the United States first three-game window.
Hey, that combination has been working very hot lately, man. Let's do it. Why not?
Genius idea. Oh, my God.
Play 4-4-1-1. Jesus and
sure.
Pepi.
Yes.
Hey, Andy, yeah. I'm sitting here looking at the first two games. Is there a particular game to you that stands out in these first two sets of games in CONCACAF that you would consider to be the biggest upset or the most unexpected result so far of the two set of games?
That's a good question. I don't know if Mexico winning on the road against Costa Rica was an upset today. Costa Rica's on a down cycle. This qualifying cycle, is not their best. And
it's just the penalty kick too, apparently.
Yeah, right. And Panama going in and maybe Panama beating up Jamaica 3-0 on the road. Maybe that's a little surprising, but Jamaica had a lot of players out, I believe, because of COVID.
Yeah.
So I don't think so. I mean, U.S. tying Canada today, maybe, right?
Yeah, I have to say, I think if you really, Canada tying the United States, I think, is probably the surprise result of these first set of games. The other thing that dawned on me is that Jamaica losing their first two games and going into this with no points and largely tied to the fact that they're missing all these players due to COVID restrictions. I wonder, is it likely that by the time the United States gets Jamaica, by the way, they play them first in the next set of games in the United States on October 7th, will Jamaica be back to load it up again?
Oh, if they freaking have Mikel Antonio by
exactly what I'm thinking.
I'm going to be irate.
That's a month away.
Yeah, that game. Yeah, now I don't know if England and the Premier League is going to have that same set of rules that they had this time in terms of not allowing players to do this or that. But I just wonder if Jamaica, by the time United States gets them, they're back at full strength by that time. That would be such an American stroke of luck. By the way, the other results from today, Jamaica did lose at home to Panama 3-0, which I think is a bit surprising. Mexico did get that win on the road in Costa Rica. El Salvador and Honduras, I heard the game was suspended due to the very mysterious and nefarious power outage. Honduras, and that ended up at donuts. And then, of course, the U.S. and Canada 1-1. The next set of games, Canada is hosting El Salvador. Costa Rica is hosting Jamaica. Panama is hosting Mexico. And Honduras hosting the United States. That game, and by the way, they pushed that U.S. game a little bit later. Now, it doesn't start till 9:30 Central Time. So I don't know if I'm going to find anybody to do a post-game pod with me at midnight. It may just be me ranting once again.
That Honduras-El Salvador result I actually consider to be a huge result for the United States because it keeps one of those teams from jumping up ahead of you because, you know, it's top three with a fourth for a playoff. So you're looking at Mexico and Canada, right? Those are the two danger teams. So the ones Honduras and El Salvador are the ones that you have to stay ahead of if you're going to get in. And so them tying is good for the United States.
Yeah, Mexico on top with 6 points, Panama in second with 4, and then Canada, Honduras, the U.S., and El Salvador with 2, Costa Rica with 1, and Jamaica with the donut hole. All right, guys, anything else that anybody wants to talk about here real quick before we wrap it up for the evening?
Yeah, the crowd in Nashville.
Yeah, what do you think?
I thought it was disappointing that they didn't sell more tickets.
What was the crowd, 40?
I think that's what they said.
Yeah, I think it was around 40K. Yeah.
And that seats 70.
Yeah, I thought the USA chant at the very beginning of the game was pretty cool when it was just that going on. But then they kept going back to that well way too much, and it takes them too long. That chant drags out far too long, in my opinion. Not that I'm a capo expert or anything, but they need to hustle. They need a higher tempo cheer when the United States needs some support from their fan base. And the other thing that I thought was disappointing is that when Canada scored, the entire mood in that place just absolutely died out. And right when the United States really needed the supporters groups to inject some enthusiasm, they were nowhere to be found.
Here's my hot take, Peter. Has Major League Soccer benefited Canada more than the United States? Is the United States almost suffering because Major League Soccer has boosted other teams in CONCACAF?
Oh, I've thought that. I've wondered that question for a long time, but I think Canada in particular. I think that's a good one. Okay. Well, Tyler, I'm sorry. Did you have something you wanted to throw in here before we close up shop?
Just that I know that it's going to sound like I'm trying to paint too rosy of a picture, but I think this was a really difficult way to start off this particular qualifying tournament, having two of your first three games on the road, starting off with a team like El Salvador, putting Canada as your middle match at home, and then all the other mitigating circumstances around players not being available and certain things like that. I know that it sounds like I'm making excuses. I'm genuinely trying not to and just trying to look at it objectively. I think that it's not the end of the world, right? I see a lot of Berhalter out, you know, on Twitter and other random places. And I don't think that the sky is falling by any means. I think they need a better performance against Honduras, and it would be awesome to get all 3 points against Honduras and really put this thing back on track. But I don't think that this is a dire circumstance yet or anything along those lines. And I'm seeing a lot of people acting as though it is. And so I just don't necessarily feel that way.
Yeah, it's the two draws, and you think about if they win the game in Honduras, you're left with the first three games with a lot of questions. But if they were to lose or draw that game in Honduras, talk about the sky falling, guys.
Yeah, I think I'm with Tyler. I actually think it's too early. I'm not worried about Panama. They've played Costa Rica and Jamaica, so Panama's not a problem. You know, Mexico and Canada are the two teams that are going to finish in the top three, it looks like to me. It's down to USA, Honduras, and El Salvador. You know, those are the guys you got to stay ahead of, and they're all tied on two. So the sky's not falling. It's way too early to be panicking. So I'm definitely not on the fire barrel halter in the middle of the eight games. That's a bad idea. But you know, I don't think anything's even remotely out of reach. And it's a type. You're right. If it goes south in Honduras, and if it goes south in the next rounds of games, then it's a big problem. But you know, there's still six games to play. So.
All right, but how do we feel about this game going into Honduras? I mean, are you guys pretty confident about not getting the loss and getting at least a point?
I think my answer is I have my confidence level is relatively low at this point. I've yet to see anything in terms of a consistent attacking threat from the team they really seem to be missing in terms of creativity. Buzz's point about a lack of people willing to take on defenders and beat them into space is alarming to me, that they don't have that. And and the other thing that we've come to realize is they're just not finishing well. Pulisic off the post today was a really unfortunate thing. There were maybe a couple of opportunities that they should have finished, but my confidence level is relatively low, but I tend to be pessimistic.
I have a higher optimism level at this point. Yeah, yeah, and that's just a general demeanor of mine, and it gets me in trouble at times. But I look at these two games. I don't think they really gave up too many clear-cut opportunities against El Salvador. I think Matt Turner made one save in that game that we talked about.
Yeah,
and then tonight I think they got beaten down the wings by some really good players like an Alphonso Davies. I think Tajon Buchanan is
that kid's
an
legit.
That kid is fantastic. And so I think they got beaten on the outside by really, really good players. And so you look at across two games, you've given up one goal and a few other chances against Canada that maybe could have and should have been put away or something along those lines. But so I go in feeling good defensively, not great offensively, but feeling like there's enough there to scrap out a goal or two and to come away with all 3 points.
All right. Well, Buzz, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We love your having your brain in this. It's a good time, man.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And Tyler, always, thank you, sir, all your insight and thoughts and upbeat, good-natured self. We love it.
It was a pleasure, gentlemen.
Hey, Andy, did you pick up on the fact that Buzz called Canada a danger team?
I know. He said, well, for sure they're going to be in the top three. He said Mexico and Canada. I was like, wait a second.
You're flying high right now.
Oh, wait, man. Canada's phenomenal, dude. Are you crazy?
They're all right.
Buzz,
they're not bad.
Going into tonight's game, you could still get plus money on Canada qualifying for the 2022 World Cup if you're putting a little sprinkle on that.
So, no, I'm not a better, but I don't know how you could watch them over the summer and not think that that's a legit team, that they're just as legit as the United States.
Yeah, we'll talk about this maybe on Wednesday's pod, but I do think there's an undiscussed advantage for some of these teams that came through the qualifying process and some of the Nations League stuff where they've been playing far more consistently as a team together than the United States has had to do. And I think that in some ways is starting to show itself a little bit. We talked about that in the Gold Cup, but Canada as a team has been playing a lot of games together for quite some time.
I just think their roster is fantastic. You know, we talked about the depth of CONCACAF, you know, and how like all these teams are pretty good. Canada's got both the solid guys across the border. They got veteran dudes they can bring in that have seen everything in the world. They got young guys. They got supreme talent that's at the highest level of the game. And they mirror the United States in many ways. So if you're going to talk about the United States or Mexico as being the cream of CONCACAF, I don't think you can leave Canada out of that conversation anymore.
Stop it, Buzz. You're going to make Andy explode with excitement.
Oh, my God. Stop my beating heart. They do have a good coach. I am a big fan of their coach.
2009 U.S. That's what they are. They're good.
Wow.
They're good.
Wow. What a reference. All right, guys. Thanks so very much. And thank you, P1s. We love and adore you. We'll talk to you Wednesday night. I assume somebody will join me after U.S. Honduras. Especially,
I'm in, Peter. You know I'm in.
All right. Awesome. Especially if it's a bad result. Everybody will be sour and maybe somebody will be drunk. But we'll talk to you Wednesday night after that. Go out, get stuck in, and win your 50s.